such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Good afternoon and welcome to Winds of Change. This is Mary Hallin Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and it is my privilege to be sitting in for Father Anthony here on WNDZ AM 750 on Winds of Change. Today is January 22nd, which is in the annals of legal history a rather sad day, because it is the day that the Supreme Court of the United States handed down two abortion decisions, Roe versus Wade and its companion case, Doe versus Bolton, which overturned the nation's abortion laws in all 50 states, and to the point that it expanded what was already permitted in terms of abortion to include children right up until the moment of birth. And it's a decision that even among those who consider themselves pro-choice has been widely and very strongly criticized for its lack of constitutional foundations. But it also really was sort of the Dred Scott of its age, taking an entire class of people and basically dehumanizing them and allowing their private killing up until the moment of birth. So there's a lot that to unpack in today's anniversary, and we're going to take a really in-depth look today at the Roe and Doe decisions. How did this happen in our country, a country where if you polled the average American, if you talked to state legislators, people more or less really very, very strongly objected to? How did we go from fairly moderate, strict abortion laws to the most liberal abortion law in the Western world in a period of a couple of years? So joining me to help me discern all of this and discuss it is Clark Forsyth, who is an attorney with the pro-life law firm Americans United for Life, and also the author of a book, Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe versus Wade. Clark, welcome.
Thanks, Mary.
Okay, thank you for being here.
So, it's good to be with you.
Clark, you have, a very long and extensive history in working to try to overturn the damage done by Roe and Doe, and you are an expert nationally in abortion law and abortion policy. Tell me, how did you come to sort of make this your niche in terms of your legal practice?
Well, back in 1984, I actually went to AUL's national conference in Chicago on abortion and the Constitution, Reversing Roe versus Wade Through the Courts, which became a book published by Georgetown University Press in 1987. And that event, and then I volunteered for Americans United for Life as an attorney while I was in private practice. Both of them inspired me to apply to AUL to be a staff counsel. I started in 1985, and I've been with AUL as an attorney for 33 years.
My goodness, yeah. So in that time, you really have had an opportunity in a way that, you know, I know so many other lawyers who are pro-life, but their practices are in tax or they're in personal injury, things like that. So they really don't have the time professionally to really sort of delve into it and really kind of make that part of their understanding. So, you know, when I see polls, even among attorneys, that don't understand the holding in Roe and its companion case Doe, it surprises me, but it doesn't surprise me. I think it reflects American opinions generally. People just simply don't grasp what Roe and Doe did, the extreme nature of the decisions. and the impact that it's had on the rest of some constitutional law in the United States, and has even influenced laws in other countries. Why don't we just start with the basic holdings in Roe and Doe? And by saying that, I know that I'm saying something that people don't even know, that Roe had a companion case, Doe versus Bolton, that was decided with Roe and handed down the same day, and their companion case is so meant to be read together. So if you could sort of give our audience, most of whom would not have a legal background, you know, just kind of your basic primer on Roe and what it did, what it didn't do, and what Doe did with it.
Well, I think what we're doing, though, is this basic education is very important year after year after year after year, because the population changes, people grow up, and you have to continually educate. As you know, these two decisions together total 150 pages of dense legalese.
Right.
Why would a non-lawyer read it? And most lawyers might read a portion in law school. So it is important to help the public always understand that Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton did two things legally. The first is they declared for the first time that there's a right to abortion protected by the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. And they defined this right in extremely broad terms. For any reason up to fetal viability, and then for any reason after viability, what was called the viability rule, for any reason after viability, for any health reason defined as even including emotional well-being.
Right. So the health decision is then laid out in the Doe decision. So Roe says you can have an abortion after viability if the mother's life or health are at stake, but they don't define what health means. Then in Doe, they go on to define health as a variety of factors, including, if I recall correctly, age, you know, your emotional state.
Emotional well-being.
Right.
Any reason. Related
right.
to health.
Right. And they even include something like along the lines of, you know, anything that involves the well-being of the patient, including her family size, her economic, you know, you could really, it's sort of an exception that swallows the rule, more or less.
Absolutely. And it means that no state, not one of the 50 states or any local government, can prohibit abortion if health is at stake at any time.
Right.
So that decision ranked the U.S. With one of only three other nations that allows abortion for any reason after fetal viability. We're one of four.
Right.
China,
right.
North Korea, Canada, and the U.S., because of Roe versus Wade, allow abortion for any reason after fetal viability. And we're one of only seven nations that allows abortion for any reason after 20 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Most nations even prohibit abortion or limit it severely after 14 weeks.
Right.
So this wasn't adopted by the people. It was imposed by the Supreme Court.
Right.
And the second hold, I mean, that's the most important thing the court did. The second holding was more legalistic. It didn't really have as significant practical implications. And that is, the court said the unborn child is not a person protected under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution.
Right.
And that's legally important, but it didn't have the practical impact of declaring a national right to abortion, because that's what swept away the abortion laws of all 50 states.
Right. And so, you know, when people say Roe versus Wade legalized abortion, technically that's not really true, because there were a number of states that had already opened up their abortion laws. New York, Colorado, California already had, you know, more or less up until viability, legal abortion. But what it did was instead to tell the states that through their democratically elected legislatures had, through, you know, voiced the will of the people, which was that mostly they wanted abortion illegal, that none of those laws are constitutional anymore. So it overturned laws rather than making something legal, correct?
It overturned every single law in the country, even the most expansive permission laws like New York State that had been enacted between 67 and 73.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's important about that. Between 67 and 73, the country and virtually every state had a debate about its abortion law.
Right.
And 30 states retained their laws prohibiting abortion except to save the life of the mother that had been in effect for hundreds of years.
Right.
But the court swept away all the laws and established, and this is what makes it unique, too. It didn't just say these laws were unconstitutional. It wrote a national abortion law.
Yeah.
And that, and who's in charge of that national abortion law? The justices.
Mm-hmm.
So they imposed it and they administer it. So they control the regulations and what laws can limit abortion in every clinic from coast to coast.
Wow.
They are, the court created the self-appointed role of the national, as the National Abortion Control Board, and has administered that role ever since as nine justices from Washington, D.C.
Right. And you know, what's so disturbing about that is that in the states where the 30 states that decided to retain very strict abortion laws, that was really based on what the people wanted. And in large part, too, it was women who wanted those laws, and it was the medical community. It was doctors themselves who said, this is bad medicine. We don't want it practiced in our state. And that's how those laws came to be enacted in the first place, with a lot of input from different women's groups. Certainly churches and religious groups had something to say about that. But it was largely the medical profession who thought that this wasn't health care.
And it shows that the court's decision is completely, was and still is completely at odds with American public opinion.
Yeah. No, and it was, I was looking at a Marist poll, I believe, that came out over the weekend or today that said really the majority of Americans, when, you know, if you just take a general poll and say, do you support Roe versus Wade? Well, of course, most people not understanding that means all 9 months for any reason. That means sex selection abortions are legal. That means, you know, as Henry Hyde used to say, eye color selection abortions are completely legal. They'll say yes. But if you sort of break down public opinion into far more specific questions, like at what point are you comfortable with abortion, people certainly aren't comfortable going beyond 12 to 14 weeks. That's universal. They are not comfortable with sex selection abortions.
A majority of Americans think that any abortion after the first trimester should be presumptively illegal.
Right.
I mean, most Americans don't support it after 12 weeks, and certainly a significant percentage of Americans don't support it even the first 12 weeks.
Okay. Well, so why do you think it is that so few Americans really understand what's going on with abortion law and policy currently, given that it seems to be an issue that's in the news so frequently, it's talked about, you know, consistently? Why do you think it is that still even then so many people are still, is that intentional on some of the abortion rights groups' part to keep the waters muddy so that people don't really know what's going on and therefore will tend to support them not really knowing what they're supporting?
Absolutely. There's a concerted effort, and there has been, I mean, even among the justices, to portray Roe as only legalizing abortion in the first trimester,
mm-hmm.
first 3 months, the first 12 weeks. I mean, even the justices, Justice O'Connor, Justice mm-hmm. Breyer, have mm-hmm. referred to Roe as legalizing early abortion.
Yeah. It's so disingenuous. And, well, you know, the interesting thing, you mentioned Justice O'Connor. In a subsequent abortion decision, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which we'll get into a little bit later in the show, she talks about Roe versus Wade as being on a collision course with itself, because she talked about how science is advancing to the point that obviously we have new technology that not only allows us to see the unborn child, but also things like, you know, we're performing surgery on unborn children, and we're, you know, so that Roe's actually at some point going to need to be reexamined. What do you make of O'Connor's remark there?
I think it was frank and tied to the facts of the abortion case that she was looking at in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
But as you know, after 1987 or 88, she got lobbied heavily by women's groups, law
okay.
professors, legal law school deans, that you're the first woman on the court and you better keep our right to abortion because
right.
this is going to shape your legacy.
Right.
And she, she went left, and in her last abortion decision on the court, or next to last,
mm-hmm.
Even voted in 2000 to strike down the prohibitions on partial birth abortion in 31 states.
Right. Yeah.
She just was lobbied heavily that this is your legacy. You have to keep the right to abortion. And she stopped being frank about the scope of the abortion right and what it all meant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as you know, in another case, she said, I don't know how the justice, I don't know how this court can say that the state can protect the doctor-patient relationship when the record in this case shows there is no such doctor-patient relationship. Oh. You know, woman, you know, that as you know, the longtime myth that this is between a woman and her doctor.
Right.
When 95% of the time, a woman doesn't go to her normal gynecologist.
And that's another understanding of the abortion industry, is that women are somehow, you know, getting their abortions from their regular OBGYNs, which is not the case. Most abortions are done in freestanding clinics, either for-profit clinics or clinics call themselves non-for-profit, but who are still making money from abortions. And women don't have, it may be the first and only time they ever see the doctor who does the abortion on them. There's no follow-up care. There's no long-term relationship in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, it's simply another way, I think, in which many women and the general public are deceived.
Absolutely. Well, and that's significant for women's health,
mm-hmm.
because it's divorced from the general gynecologist obstetrician that takes care of the woman, and that should be in her medical record.
Right.
Her longtime gynecologist should know that she's had an abortion,
right.
or more than one,
right.
and that it has future risks for future births, for future pregnancies, for her increased risk of breast cancer, and her increased risk of mental trauma after the abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Her doctor should know that.
Right. Oh, I remember, you know, my first OB appointments with all of my children, it is one of the first two or three questions you're asked: have you had any previous pregnancies or miscarriages? Have you had any abortions? Because your OB needs to know that to be able to treat you well. Well, Clark, when we come back from this break, we are going to get into how all of this happened. To paraphrase Hillary Clinton, what happened? How did we get to this point? This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on WNDZ, AM 750. Don't go away.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the Donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
Pope John Paul II once said, "Humanity, its dignity and its balance, at every moment and on every place on earth, will depend upon who he is for her and who she is for him." I am Father Thomas Lawyer with a Theology of the Body moment for the Tabor Life Institute. Why are we a man? Why are we a woman? Unless we know the why, we do not know the how to be man or a woman, and therefore we do not know how to really be for each other. The why behind being a man or woman is told in the theology of our gendered bodies. Our bodies speak a language. Gender reveals God. Through gender, we can actually participate in the way that God loves us. We can love as God loves. Human sexuality is an icon of the very interior life of the Holy Trinity. To find out more about the theology of the body, visit taborlife.org. taborlife.org.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And I have the great privilege, and I do mean privilege, of being joined this hour by Clark Forsyth, who is a constitutional attorney who specializes in abortion law, particularly abortion law as it pertains to the U.S. Constitution and to the Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton decisions. Clark really is considered one of the nation's leading experts and authorities on these two particular cases. And so, Clark, your book, Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe v. Wade, available at Amazon.com and other bookstores near you, is, I remember at the time when it came out, 2 years ago, yes? Or is it more than that now?
2013.
2013. Oh, my goodness. 5 years ago. How time flies. All right. But reading at the time the reviews of your book, and even those people, those lawyers who would have very different opinions about legal abortion, were very, very complimentary of your book and the scholarship that went into it. Why did you decide to write a book just on the Roe decision?
Back in 2009, I had a lot of questions about how the decision is still so controversial. How did they do it? Why did they do it?
Mm-hmm.
What did they have in front of them? What kind of evidence? What kind of record? What kind of facts? You know, what did they know about fetology and fetal medicine? What did they know about the medical implications of abortion for women? And so I went back and got the audio of the decisions. In fact, you can hear the audio at a website called oyez.org, which is oyez.org, which is about the Supreme Court. And it has the original audio. It has original transcripts. But then I wanted to know, where are the justices' papers? Are they, can I find them? What do they reveal? So eventually I looked at the papers of 8 of the 9 justices who voted in Roe versus Wade, all but Chief Justice Burgers, which are still private and under seal and don't come out until 2025. But those papers, those personal papers of the justices, tell a completely different story than the public has heard before.
Interesting.
And basically that the decision was more manipulative, seat of the pants, more arbitrary and capricious than the public has heard before, because they didn't have a trial, they didn't have any a record, they didn't have a medical record, they didn't have expert witnesses, they didn't have any reliable medical data. It was very result-oriented, and they decided, we're going to sweep away the abortion laws now. How do we write it?
Right.
How do we justify it?
Well, I know that Justice Blackmun, who was the author of the Roe decision, his own law clerk, who himself said, I am utterly committed to the right to choose, said, as a matter of constitutional interpretation and judicial method, Roe versus Wade borders on the indefensible. Why do you think he made a statement like that?
Because he's one of scores of scholars the entire spectrum of academia who have recognized that Blackmun's opinion in Roe versus Wade falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make any sense. It's been thoroughly, exhaustively, repeatedly, harshly criticized from start to finish. And because of that, as of 1992, in the Casey decision, as you know, Mary, the court basically abandoned it.
Mm-hmm.
Abandon
right.
the rationale.
They abandoned the viability standard.
Abandon
right.
that. Abandon Roe versus Wade. Abandon the opinion by Blackmun. And they basically said, we're going to adopt a new rationale for the abortion right, and that is that women have come to rely upon abortion for equal opportunity in American society, and that's why we have a right to abortion.
Okay.
So
So there's a reliance factor now, according to the Casey decision, based on what amendment? Is this still a 14th Amendment situation, or have they moved on now to applying other amendments of the Constitution to, you know, the quote-unquote right to abortion?
Still the 14th Amendment, but still so-called a liberty right or liberty interest in the 14th Amendment. But the rationale for why they find it there, even though the Constitution doesn't say anything about abortion, it doesn't need to say anything about privacy. The rationale for why they stick to an abortion right is women's reliance interests, that women have come to rely upon abortion for equal opportunity in American
right.
society. And I think they, in 92, they got that completely wrong.
Right.
Because there was no evidence of such reliance. And as you know, the abortion rate over the last decade has declined significantly
mm-hmm.
to the lowest level since 73 or 72.
Right.
It's turned around completely. What I think, frankly, the justices should have recognized is that women haven't come to rely upon abortion. If men and women have relied on anything, it's contraception, not abortion.
Right, right. But though she does point out as well, I believe the quote from the, I'd have to look at this up, but women have learned to rely on abortion when their contraception fails them. So abortion has become, that's right in the Supreme Court's decision, so abortion has kind of become the backup to failed contraceptive methods. Now you make an interesting point when you say that abortion is mentioned nowhere in the Constitution. And if I remember back from my law school days, the justices, Justice Blackmun spoke about, or maybe this was Brennan, the emanations and penumbras that come out of the 14th Amendment. So nothing's really mentioned specifically, but there are these penumbras and emanations that are out there, and we're pretty sure abortion's in there somewhere, just floating out there where emanations and penumbras float, I guess. Talk about that a little bit, because that is, you know, this even the right to privacy, like you say, is not really mentioned, you know, specifically. How did they go about crafting this? This is where I really want to hear how you took apart the decision. You mentioned you listened to every oral argument tape, which I want to hear about. But also, what I think a lot of people don't know, and I don't think I even fully understood this, there's really no court record leading up to the Supreme Court decisions. There's no medical expert testimony. There's no witness testimony. Tell us how Roe all started. I know it starts with Jane Doe and...
Well, that's right. There were attorneys, abortion advocates, attorneys who wanted to legalize abortion in Texas and Georgia, and they found two women who they could represent in court, Jane Roe and Mary Doe.
Right.
But as you know, they years later became pro-life advocates.
Both of them, yeah.
Completely turned around, repudiated what they had done in those two cases, testified before Congress and before the Supreme Court that Roe should be overturned. But these attorneys used these two women to go into court and challenge the abortion laws. And they, because of some procedural rules that were in effect at the time, they took these two cases directly to the Supreme Court. But there was, as you said, you summarized it nicely, there was no medical record, there was no trial, there were no expert witnesses, there was no reliable medical data. There was nothing about the implications of abortion. But when they took it up to the Supreme Court in late 1971, they came to the court at a unique time in American history, the end of the 60s and the sexual revolution, and a unique time in the Supreme Court, because Justice Black and Justice Harlan, who I think would have voted against a right to abortion, resigned in September of 71 before the oral arguments due to ill health. Black died a week later. There's a big national funeral. Harlan died at the end of December. And those two vacancies reduced the number of justices to seven, flipped the court to a 4-3 temporary majority, and those four wanted to use these two cases to sweep away the abortion laws before President Nixon could fill the vacancies. And they pushed it and created such momentum that they voted to overturn the abortion laws and eventually did so after it was re-argued in 1972. So if those two vacancies hadn't occurred in this unique historical moment, I don't think the court would have done what it did. What I point out in abuse of discretion is that the decision is so weak and the deliberations were so weak and the reasoning was so weak that it explains why the decision is unsettled 45 years later.
Right.
They did such a poor job and they created such a self-inflicted wound on the court that it helps explain why the decision is unsettled. And I think it points the way to how we can move forward in overturning the decision as quickly as the change in the court will permit.
Well, so you mentioned that that there was this there's an impetus to before President Nixon could fill those two vacancies to get this these two particular cases in on the court's docket for that upcoming term. Correct.
Correct.
Okay. And so, what in all of your research and listening to the tapes and going back and looking at their papers, did you discern any particular unifying, you know, motivation behind the four justices who pushed this through? Other than a couple of groups in New York and California, I'm not aware of a really organized, well-funded abortion lobby movement at that time. Do you have a sense of sort of what was behind this, or was it an abortion lobby that was simply sort of trying to push its way through the courts?
Well, there was a well-organized, well-funded effort by abortion advocates. Women's organizations actually came kind of late to the process in 68, 69, 70.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Rockefeller money was funding the litigation efforts.
Gotcha.
And there were the funders who were there. I mean, Warren Buffett has been, you know, funding abortion since the 60s. So there were funders and there were advocacy organizations. But the motivation of the four, and eventually it was seven, were somewhat mixed, but they were all toward overturning the abortion laws. I mean, some were pushed by their families and encouraged by their families and their wives and their daughters.
Mm-hmm.
Some had, were frankly philanderers and wanted to push, topple the abortion laws for decades.
Right.
And it was the end of the sexual revolution, and they were caught up in the sexual revolution. Some had personal experience of family involvement with abortion or an unwed pregnancy, and population control was a national issue.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Even President Nixon, in July of 1969, gave a national address, pushing population control.
Right.
And some of the justices said, "Hey, abortion is going to help us control population.
Right.
We got to legalize it."
Yeah, I remember from, reading through some excerpts from the Rockefeller Commission on Population, and they overwhelmingly voted in support, the commission did, that was advising Nixon on legalizing abortion. And I think there was one of only two dissenters, and it was a Hispanic woman who, I love this quote, she said, "The poor cry out for justice and mercy, and we respond with legal abortion." And as a Hispanic woman, she said, I see where this is targeted. It is get rid of the poor rather than take care of the poor. So, Clark, when we come back from this break, we're going to continue to delve into your book, Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe versus Wade. Listeners, please don't go anywhere. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony here on AM 750 WNDZ.
We at Winds of Change thank you for your prayers and financial support. As you have often heard, Winds of Change is listener supported. That means you, and especially now. Please give what you can to help support Winds of Change to stay on the air. Any amount will be greatly appreciated. Simply go to ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And click on the radio button to make your donation to Winds of Change, which will be a tremendous blessing. Thank you.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
How long has it been since you have been to church? Busy schedule, work, or just lost interest? To be Catholic is not just merely attending Mass as just another weekend activity to be checked off the to-do list. Participation in the sacred liturgy gives you the opportunity to be intimately connected to Christ through the Holy Eucharist. You can also cleanse yourself of sin through the sacrament of reconciliation as a baptized Catholic. Come before the iconic monstrance to be in Christ's presence in the sacred silence of the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy. St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. St. Stan's is just off the Kennedy, 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Come back to Christ through the sacred liturgy and his gift of the sacraments at St. Stan's.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And today, January 22nd, is the 45th anniversary of the Supreme Court's handing down the Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton decisions, which overturned the nation's abortion laws in all 50 states. And joining me to, explore Roe and Doe and how this all happened is Clark Forsythe, who is a constitutional lawyer and scholar and the author of the book Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe versus Wade, available at Amazon and other booksellers near you. Clark, thank you again for being with us for this entire hour. It is a great gift to have you here. Your book really takes us through the entire kind of origins of Roe and then its endings. And at the risk of sounding like one of those Schoolhouse Rock, videos that you used to see that tell you about how a law becomes a bill or how something gets to the Supreme Court, can you kind of walk us back to those two original cases and tell us how they wound up getting to the Supreme Court in as quickly as they did?
Well, in a number of cases have been filed about against 20 state abortion laws in the in 68, 69, 70, 71, and these two cases from Georgia and Texas were two of the 20 or so that were filed in the courts. They were appealed to the Supreme Court in 1970, right at the end of the flourish of state laws that had been passed in the states that had legalized abortion in 14 states. And they came to the court right before Justice Black and Harlan retired and created a crisis in the court,
right,
because there were these twin vacancies.
And both considered conservatives, correct?
Yes, or at least I think they would have voted against a national right to abortion. So Roe versus Wade, in a significant extent, was a historical oddity, was a historical mistake that happened because of the unique situation in the court. So these two retirements by Black and Harlan made an opening for four pro-abortion justices to look at these two cases and say, hey, these are the vehicles that will enable us to overturn Roe versus Wade. Let's take these two cases. We can sweep away the abortion laws, declare a national right to abortion, and we can do it before these vacancies are filled by President Nixon.
Okay.
And they were able to push these two cases along through the court. And when in January of 1972, when President Nixon filled the vacancies with Justice Powell and Justice Rehnquist, the court had already voted to legalize abortion. And the cases were re-argued in October of 72, and the court voted eventually 7-2 to overturn the abortion laws, and that decision was released in January of 73. But it was all because of that historical moment in which Harlan and Black retired, and these four justices said, this is how we're going to legalize abortion, and we're going to release that decision and sweep away the abortion laws as quickly as we can.
Okay. And so who were the two dissenters?
Well, ultimately, it was Justice White and Justice Rehnquist who dissented in 73 and then remained dissenters throughout their time on the court.
Yes.
They, you know, basically saying, we told you so. You
right.
shouldn't have done this.
Right.
And they until they retired from the court in the 90s, and Chief Justice Rehnquist in 2005, they were dissenters who said, if you do this, these are the problems you're going to create. And for the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, they were able to point out that the court should never have made the mistake of overturning the abortion laws and should have left it to the people in the states.
Right, exactly, which is if Roe versus Wade were to be overturned, would be what would happen, right? It would go back to the people in the states and individual state legislatures to, you know, assess the will of the people in those particular states, and the people would decide what they wanted the abortion law to be.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. I mean, right. There's this urban legend out there that if Roe versus Wade is overturned, that means abortion's immediately made illegal.
Correct.
That's false. It means it would go back to the states, and whatever law is on the books in, say, Illinois or Indiana or mm-hmm. Iowa is the way the law would be. And then the legislature would have an opportunity and the governor to change the abortion laws. But that means that if Roe versus Wade was overturned today,
mm-hmm.
abortion would be legal tomorrow in 45 or 50 states.
Right.
Because there aren't prohibitions on the books before 20 weeks or before viability.
Correct.
So there would be no immediate legal change.
Correct.
But I believe that once the issue is returned to the states, you would see states moving to limit abortion, and you would see, I think, a more pro-life public policy in a short period of time
mm-hmm.
than the court has imposed on the country.
Right. Well, you know, and it's interesting, you know, a couple of different factors in play here. I know, for example, in Illinois, I remember from my Illinois Constitution class that Illinois had a particular statute on the books that said if Roe was ever overturned, Illinois was one of those states that would go back to the pre-1973 law, which was fairly restrictive in terms of, you know, the time in which and places in which a woman could have an abortion. But as part of HB 40, the new law that Governor Rauner signed, which now expands public funding of abortion to all Medicaid recipients here in Illinois and to all state employees, that also undid that provision that would go back to what the people of Illinois had voted on at the time. You know, kind of to your point, Clark, I think that, you know, public opinion on abortion, you know, again, depending the questions people are asked and stuff, it has been so influenced by science, extraordinarily so. And, you know, we have now, of course, now new scientific information on fetal pain, and we have such advances in neonatology. You know, I have a nephew who was born at 22 weeks, 0 days, and who is perfectly fine and normal and healthy. And, you know, that was considered unthinkable even probably 5 or 6 years ago. So
I think that's very significant. Mm-hmm. And in fact, as I point out in Abuse of Discretion, I think the justices were blindsided by ultrasound because they heard from Dorothy Beasley, who was the assistant attorney general for Georgia, who strongly defended the Georgia limit on abortion. She talked about fetology. She talked about fetal medicine. But ultrasound wasn't on the commercial market, and it didn't come on the commercial market in the United States until about 3 or 4 years after the Roe versus Wade decision, 76, 77. And I think the justices were completely blindsided by ultrasound. And that has changed American public opinion permanently.
Right. Yeah. Well, and so Dorothy Beasley, it sounds like, made a very persuasive argument to the justices. How, in when you were listening to the tapes and reviewing their papers, did they just dismiss what she had to say? Or, you know, what was she not at all just able to break through? Or had they just already basically made up their minds before oral arguments, and oral arguments were just a formality?
They made up their minds before the arguments, and they were already ready to write a decision to sweep away the abortion laws. But you can go back to oyez.org, O-Y-E-Z.org, and you can hear the original arguments by Dorothy Beasley.
Wow.
And she was... She's a name that's been lost to history because, as you know, the media is focused on Sarah Weddington, the pro-abortion attorney.
Right.
But if you listen to Dorothy Beasley, she was much more articulate and quick on her feet, and she had answers for every single question from the justices because she was an experienced Supreme Court litigator and arguer.
Wow.
And for a
woman in the early 70s to have a position, that's very interesting.
She had a wonderful career in Georgia law and argued these cases and did very well. And they basically ignored what she had to say. And they ignored the warnings that she gave them. That they didn't have the facts.
Okay.
They didn't have
the medical facts, meaning.
That's right. They didn't have any facts about abortion or its implications.
Right.
Including medical information. They didn't have any facts about the implications of late-term abortions. They didn't have the facts about the implications of late-term abortions for women's health. They didn't have anything. And she pointed that out repeatedly. And when I interviewed her in 2010 or 2011...
Is she still alive now?
She may be.
Okay.
She had an illustrious career in Georgia law and ended up as chief judge of the Georgia Court of Appeals. But I could tell even in 2010 when I interviewed her, she was frustrated at what had happened because she told them, you don't have any facts here. There was no evidence. You don't know about the implications of abortion. She talked about fetal medicine and fetal therapy and fetology, and she talked about the law, the prenatal injury law, wrongful death law, homicide law that protected the unborn child. And she said, you know, you're going to create you're going to create a schizophrenia here with what the states have done. You should leave it to the states.
Well, okay, so that is a point I was going to ask you about later, a little bit later, but since you've raised it, let's go there. So in what other contexts are unborn children recognized and protected by the law? You mentioned fetal homicide. You mentioned, I believe, inheritance laws. Can you kind of expound on that a little bit?
We have a long legal tradition of the law protecting the unborn child according to contemporary medical knowledge. And that has expanded. Medical knowledge has expanded over the years. I mean, you know, imagine a time before modern medicine, modern medical technology, stethoscopes, mm-hmm. fetal monitoring technology, before even electricity.
Right.
And the only thing we knew about pregnancy was, well, when the woman quickened, when she felt fetal movements,
right.
and when birth came.
Right, right.
And that's about all we knew.
Right.
So the law couldn't protect the unborn child to a great degree, but it recognized that this is a person. This is a human being, and we'll protect it to the greatest extent possible. But even before Roe versus Wade in the 20th century, the law was moving ahead with prenatal injury.
Mm-hmm.
The law was moving ahead with wrongful death law, treating the unborn child as a human being or a person that could be protected in tort law. And the states were moving ahead with even fetal homicide laws
right.
a little bit before Roe versus Wade. And the court just ignored all of that. And created this schizophrenia, which has been a means to educate the public that this is a human being, the law is protected. And then the states, since the Supreme Court opened the way for the states to continue to protect the unborn child, because Roe versus Wade deals only with abortion law.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed the states to move ahead with prenatal injury law, wrongful death law, fetal homicide law.
Right.
And the states
laws,
have done
yeah.
that.
Right. And so how many states now have fetal homicide laws?
38 or 39 now. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is that 25 states,
mm-hmm.
half the states in this country,
mm-hmm.
including Illinois,
mm-hmm.
Has a fetal homicide law that extends protection from conception.
Right. And you don't even need to know that the woman is pregnant if you commit a murder against her. The fact that you don't have knowledge of that is irrelevant. You will be charged with two homicides. Yeah, yep. it's a, like you say, a very schizophrenic way to look at the unborn child, and it's really only this private killing that is permitted, you know, this private injury against them that's permitted. And, you know, another aspect where we've seen a lot of advancement is our knowledge of fetal pain. And I have, there's a really good article, listeners, in The Atlantic, of all places, Does the Pro-Life Movement Have Science on Its Side?, where they interview neonatologists, psychologists, attorneys, and, you know, it's very fairly written. I was a little, nervous about reading it, given The Atlantic's kind of left-leaning views, but it's actually a fairly fairly written article, and really taking both sides into consideration. And I had posted it on my Facebook page, and a friend of mine, who is a pediatric anesthesiologist, wrote, she said, what I would like to say is this. Fetuses who require surgery while in utero, because we can do that now, also require an anesthetic provided by a pediatric anesthetic team separate from the mother's anesthetic team. And the fetus typically receives an intramuscular shot of fentanyl. If they were insensible to pain, they wouldn't need anesthesia. So this is from a friend who assists when there are surgeries done in utero on unborn children on their need for pain control. So I think that is something we're going to be seeing more and more in the abortion debate going forward. So, Clark, we're going to take our final break now. And when we come back, we're going to talk about where you see things going forward in the future with Roe versus Wade. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the divine mercy, where you can enter into the presence of Christ 24/7. Every first Saturday afternoon will be a special opportunity for healing. At 4:30, bring your petitions for our Blessed Mother's intercession as we pray the rosary. Then, at 5, we share the body of Christ in the Holy Mass. Also, at 5:30, a Spanish Mass, followed by a Eucharistic procession, adoration, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and an anointing. Enter into the sacred space of St. Stanislaus Kostka and place yourself before Christ for healing. On first Saturday afternoon, starting at 4:30, find St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, 2 blocks north of Division, on Noble, just off the Kennedy in Chicago, and find peace and healing.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
Do you have loved ones who are away from the church? Do you feel helpless, anxious, or concerned because people you love no longer consider themselves Catholic? My name is Sister Teresa Alethea Noble. I am a religious sister with the Daughters of St. Paul, but I am also a former atheist. I was raised Catholic, but rejected my faith for over 10 years. Evangelizing our friends and family is the most difficult kind of evangelization, but it is possible. I have written a book called The Prodigal You Love, Inviting Loved Ones Back to the Church, to help you invite your loved ones back to the church. You can find more information about this book at pauline.org/prodigalyoulove. Together, let's start an evangelization revolution.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And I am joined today by Clark Forsythe, who is the author of probably one of the most comprehensive books ever written on the Roe versus Wade decision. It's called Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe versus Wade. It's the quickest and fastest and cheapest way to get it, Clark tells me, is on Amazon, but could likely be ordered through bookstores near you if you are one of those people who still go to the brick-and-mortar bookstore. So, Clark, we spent the last 45 minutes discussing really the background of Roe, how this came to be, why a law that so badly reflected the will of the American people, a law that is criticized even by people who support legal abortion for having basically no constitutional basis and being an incredible example of judicial overreach. But yet, you know, it and Planned Parenthood have defined the abortion law in our country for the last 45 years. Where do you think, might we go from here?
Well, I think we need to continue a broadly based legal, political, educational strategy. But we're here on the 45th anniversary. And one of the reasons we're talking about this, Mary, is because Roe versus Wade is unsettled. Mm-hmm. If it was settled, we probably wouldn't be talking about it, but it is unsettled. And it's unsettled because of the political momentum of the pro-life movement and the legislative momentum and the legal momentum. You know, the November 2016 elections produced the best political conditions for pro-life work in the courts and the legislatures since Roe versus Wade. Mm-hmm. We have pro-life majorities in the legislatures of 30 states.
Okay, great.
We've got pro-life governors in 25 to 30 states. You know, most of the Midwest and the Southeast and the Southwest and the Midwest from North Dakota down to Texas are pro-life states. Mm-hmm. And the political result in Congress from the November 2016 elections, the political result in the states is more pro-life than at any time since Roe versus Wade. In addition, you've talked about science, ultrasound. Mm-hmm. That has created momentum, our knowledge of fetal pain. In addition, there is a growing body of international medical data showing increased risk of preterm birth after abortion, increased risk of breast cancer after abortion, increased risk of mental trauma after abortion. This data didn't exist in 1973. So science and medicine is on our side. And I think the real challenge for us going forward is to continue to make the case in the public that abortion's bad for both mother and child.
Right.
But we need to be working in education and educating that abortion's bad for both. We need to continue to work in politics. We're going to have a political moment perhaps in the summer of this year, when there might be another retirement from the Supreme Court. We need to continue to push on the administration, on members of Congress and the Senate to change the court and replace retiring justices with justices who are pro-life or anti-abortion. We need to continue to be working in the states. So we need to continue to be working in legislation and politics and push as hard as we have up to now. We can't let up. We're making progress. We've established momentum, but we need to continue to push. And as you know, I was in Washington this past Friday at the March for Life, and to my mind, it was the biggest and most enthusiastic ever.
Yeah.
And that is...
It looked that way. I wasn't able to go this year, but it looked massive this year.
It was massive, and it was the first time that the president, the vice president, and the speaker of the House have spoken to the march.
All together.
That's right.
Same march, yeah.
Which shows the political momentum. And the march is important because, as you know, they are there for one reason, to protest Roe versus Wade and the Supreme Court's decision.
Right.
Year after year after year, in increasing in size and enthusiasm and positive outlook. All of this must continue because just as we are pushing to overturn Roe versus Wade, there are mm-hmm. powerful forces in this country pushing to prop it up.
Oh, powerful and very well funded. And that's another aspect I think people don't realize is the amount of money that the abortion industry generates for the people who are behind it, and therefore it's a powerful reason for them to want to hold on to it every single last aspect that they can. But so Clark, if there was, you know, going forward, what kind of issues might present the challenge to Roe that would help to break down this sort of, you know, lock hold that the abortion industry has on the law in the states?
Virtually any pro-life legislation could create a test case.
Can you think of an example?
A 20-week limit.
Okay. All right. So
21 states have passed a 20-week limit, a five-month limit on abortion since 2010.
And that's not enforceable. That's actually unconstitutional under Roe and Doe, is it not?
Technically it is, but yeah. Most of those laws are in effect because they haven't been challenged in the court.
Okay.
Parental notice or consent law, a dismemberment law, first trimester prohibition, even a limit on public funding of abortion. Any law that arguably conflicts with Roe or Doe could create a test case. But as you know, as we're sitting here, we have a 5-4 pro-abortion majority on the court.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't want to see a test case in the court until we've got a shift in the court.
And so, well, do you think, though, with Anthony Kennedy as that sort of kind of wiggly, you know, vote, if I don't think he's a solidly strong vote, and he seems to me to be able to be persuaded by common sense in some areas. Do you think, for example, the 20-week ban, I can't imagine, you know, just having viewed them for the last 20 years like you have, the abortion industry sitting quietly with the 20-week ban, frankly. I think at some point, some late-term abortion provider is going to say, listen, you are cutting in significantly to my business by doing this, and challenge it, because 20-week bans are, I don't even know how they get past state legislatures because they are unconstitutional. Has that argument been made?
The argument's been made, but it just reflects public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It reflects public opinion in the states. I mean, virtually every public opinion poll has showed that a majority of Americans support a prohibition of abortion, even after the first trimester.
Right, right.
Even Huffington Post polls show majority support for 20-week limits.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a reflection of where public opinion is. And so the states have moved ahead. But as a practical matter, I don't see a case, or there won't be a case, challenging a 20-week limit that will get there before Justice Kennedy might retire.
Okay.
And
do you think he's persuadable based on some of his jurisprudence that you've read?
Well, I think there's an important distinction between, is he persuadable to uphold a 20-week limit? Maybe, but he's he's avowedly said in many cases he's holding to Roe versus Wade, so he's not a vote to overturn Roe versus Wade.
Okay, or Doe versus Bolton. Yeah.
That's right. So he would have to be replaced by another justice, and there's been talk of Justice Ginsburg perhaps retiring
right.
or leaving the court in the next couple of years, there has to be further change in the court. That means a president and a Senate that will approve those justices.
Okay. Well, this has been, an incredibly interesting and illuminating conversation. Clark Forsythe, thank you so much. It meant a lot to me personally that you came in to talk about your book with us today. This has been Mary Fiorito. I've been sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change. Remember, you can get Abuse of Discretion, The Inside Story of Roe versus Wade, at Amazon.com. If you're interested in learning more about abortion law in the United States, how this came to be, I'd highly recommend it. And we will see you next Monday. God bless everyone.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? Meaningless thought, the shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The